that the newly discovered site might be 5,000 years old. But there is no basis for this, or really for any date. All we can say for sure is that the earliest surviving historical mention of Turkey's underground cities is found in the Anabapsis of the Greek historian Xenophon, written in the 4th century BC. So they are older than that. But the question is, how much older? As the reader will recall from Chapter 1, there's no objective way to date structures made entirely of rock. What archaeologists look for, therefore, are organic materials that can be carbon dated. To be useful, however, these organic materials must be excavated from locations under a megalith that has never been moved, for example, or in the original mortar in a joint between two stone blocks, that allow reasonable deductions to be made about the date the associated structural elements were put in place. This is why the mysterious decision by the builders of Göbekli Tepe to bury the megalithic enclosures there has been so helpful to archaeology. Once buried, they stayed buried, and organic materials in the fill can thus be used to make valuable inferences about their age. In many other sites, by contrast, there is the possibility that the intrusion of later organic materials will give a falsely young date, and in some, the underground cities of Turkey being a prime example, no reliable dating can be done. This is because the sites were used, reused, and indeed repurposed many times down the ages by many different peoples, with organic materials being introduced on every occasion, thus making it impossible to draw any inferences about the epoch of their original construction. The general view of archaeologists is that the underground structures were originally developed in the 7th or 8th centuries BC. By an Indo-European people called the Phrygians, who lived in Cappadocia at the time. The theory is that the Phrygians began the project by widening and deepening natural caves and tunnels that already existed in the volcanic rock, making use of the spaces they created for storage and possibly as places of refuge from attackers. By Roman times, with the Phrygians long gone, the inhabitants of the area were Greek-speaking Christians who further developed and expanded the underground caverns, rededicating some of the rooms as chapels and leaving inscriptions in Greek, some of which survive to this day. In the Byzantine era, from the 8th to the 12th centuries AD, the Eastern Roman Empire was locked in wars with newly Islamicized Arabs, and the underground cities became places of refuge again. A function they continued to serve during the Mongol invasions of the 14th century AD. Later still, Greek Christians used the cities to escape persecution at the hands of Turkish Muslim rulers, and this practice continued into the 20th century, when the structures finally fell into disuse after the truce and population exchange between Greece and Turkey in 1923. With such a checkered history, it's easy to see why the underground cities cannot be dated using objective archaeological techniques. Moreover, the vast effort that went into their excavation out of solid rock and their sophisticated ventilation systems speak of powerful, long-term motives far beyond the limited and temporary need for shelter from attackers. With this in mind, let us consider a scenario in which the Phrygians, favored for no good reason by archaeologists as the first makers of the cities, were themselves just one of the many later cultures to make use of them. It is perfectly possible that this is the case, and if so, then it is also possible that these extraordinary underground structures might date back to a time long before the Phrygians, perhaps even as far back as the fatal winters of the Younger Dryas that set in around 12,800 years ago. There is no proof of this, of course. Nonetheless, Turkish historian and archaeologist Ömer Demir, author of Cappadocia, Cradle of History, is of the opinion that Derinkuyu does in fact date back to the Paleolithic. His argument is based partly on the notion that it already existed in Phrygian times, partly on stylistic differences between the upper, older levels and the lower, younger levels, and partly on the fact that marks of the implements used to cut the rock have worn completely away in the upper levels but are still visible in the lower levels. It is necessary for a long period of time to pass for the chisel marks to disappear. This means that there was quite a time difference between the years of construction of the first stories and the last stories. Demir also suggests that the huge quantities of rock excavated to make the underground city, which are nowhere in evidence in the vicinity today, were dumped into local streams and carried off. In one of these streams, the Sognali, at a distance of 26 kilometers, 16 miles from Derinkuyu, hand axes, rock chips, and other Paleolithic artifacts were found. The evidence is suggestive at best. I wouldn't want to bet my life or my reputation on it. Nonetheless, the scenario that sees Derinkuyu and the other underground cities constructed in the Upper Paleolithic around 12,800 years ago at the onset of the Younger Dryas has the great merit of no longer leaving us casting about for a motive commensurate with the huge effort involved. We're informed of that motive quite explicitly in the story of Yima. Stated simply, the cities are Varas, cut down into the depths of the earth as places of refuge from the horrors of the Younger Dryas, which were not limited to the vehement destroying frost, but as we know from the cosmic impacts ferules and melt glass found in sediment samples at nearby Abu Huraira, also included the terrifying threat of bombardment from the skies. Like a snake out of the sky. It is close to certain, if our planet did indeed cross the path of a giant comet 12,800 years ago, as Firestone, Kennett, and West maintain, that the bombardment would not have been limited to the large fragments that came down during the first event. The comet's debris stream would have remained on an Earth-crossing orbit and would very likely have resulted in decades, perhaps even centuries, of subsequent bombardments, not on the same scale of intensity as the initial encounter, but nonetheless able to cause catastrophic damage and to spread enough fear and dismay of the mighty serpent lingering in the heavens to justify the construction of secure underground shelters. Indeed, as we will see, the Earth may still cross the debris stream of the giant Younger Dryas comet today, and large, deadly objects, blacker than coal, invisible to our telescopes, may still be orbiting in that stream today. I'm reminded again of the Ojibwa prophecy, reviewed in Chapter 3. The star with the long white tail is going to destroy the world someday, when it comes low again. That's the comet called Long-Tailed Heavenly Climbing Star. Is the Younger Dryas comet coming back? Could it be that it did not spend all its anger and destructive force with the fragments that hit the Earth and caused the vehement destroying winter of the Younger Dryas 12,800 years ago? Curiously, the ancient Iranian traditions contain a prophecy also, for it is said that Yima will return and will walk again amongst men when the signs foreshadowing the last of days appear. Of these, the worst will be a winter more terrible than any the world has seen before, when it will rain and snow and hail for 3 long years. The fiery descent of more fragments of the comet could bring about such a winter, just as happened 12,800 years ago. And just as happened then, it would do so in part because the skies would be darkened by debris and smoke from the wildfires caused by airbursts and by the superheated ejecta from the impacts on land. These are grave matters, and we will return to them in Chapter 19. But first, we must consider the story of Noah, the Hebrew counterpart of Yima. Carried by the waters of the flood, so we are told, to the slopes of Mount Ararat, just a few days' walk from Göbekli Tepe, the Noah story also contains a prophecy, which is made manifest in the New Testament, 2 Peter 3, verses 3 to 7. By water, the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. By the same word, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. Or as the old song has it, God gave Noah the rainbow sign. No more water. The fire next time. Chapter 8. The Antediluvians. The biblical story of the deluge is too familiar to require extensive repetition here. The essential elements can be summarized as follows. A life-destroying global flood sent by God to punish human wickedness. A man, Noah, selected by God, and given advance warning of the coming cataclysm so that he can build a survival ship, the Ark. The preservation in the Ark of the seeds or breeding pairs of all forms of life, with a particular emphasis on human life. Noah and his wife, together with their sons and their wives, and animal life, of fowls after their kind, as we saw in the last chapter, and of cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind, two of every sort shall come unto thee to keep them alive. The ark rides out the flood until the waters subside. The ark comes to rest on the mountains of Ararat. When the waters have dried up from the earth, God instructs Noah to leave the ark with his family and to bring out every kind of living creature that is with you, the birds, the animals, and all the creatures that move along the ground, so they can multiply on the earth and be fruitful and increase in number on it. Noah builds an altar on which he sacrifices some of the animals and birds that he has just saved from the flood. The smell of the burnt offerings is pleasing to God. The surviving humans and animals go forth and multiply and fill the earth, as they have been commanded. Mount Ararat rises to 5,137 meters, 16,853 feet, and geologists assure us, on the basis of excellent science, that no part of it has ever been covered by oceanic floodwaters since it began to take shape as a mountain near the end of the early Miocene, some 16 million years ago. The presence of anatomically modern humans in the world, as we saw in the last chapter, cannot be traced back further than 200,000 years, and even the last common ancestor with the chimpanzee, a creature that was very far from being in any sense human, takes us back barely 6 million years. So the notion of a boat with humans on board being washed up on Mount Ararat is a chronological impossibility. Nonetheless, it is intriguing that the story of the deluge as given in the Old Testament makes specific and deliberate mention of the mountains of Ararat. The mount does in fact have twin peaks, which in biblical times were understood as being part of the kingdom of Ararat, the historic land of Urartu, conquered by the Assyrian king Shalmaneser in the late 2nd millennium BC. Due to the limited archaeology that has been undertaken in the region, historians confess that the origins of Urartu must remain obscure, but the earliest known settlements and the beginnings of agriculture in the region have been traced back to approximately 10,000 to 9,000 BC, in other words, to the period of Göbekli Tepe. Moreover, this whole area, Mount Ararat and Göbekli Tepe very much included, formed the heartland of historic Armenia, the direct descendant of the biblical kingdom of Ararat, whose inhabitants saw and still today see themselves as the peoples of Ararat. Written in the 5th century AD, Moses Korenatsi's influential History of the Armenians attributed the founding of the nation to the patriarch Haik, who it was said was the great-great-great-grandson of Noah himself, and thus in the close lineage of the flood survivors who emerged from the ark. Indeed, it is because of Haik that even in the 21st century Armenians still refer to themselves as Hai and to their land as Hayastan. They see it simply as a tragedy of history that so much of this land, again including Göbekli Tepe and Mount Ararat, is now in the possession of the Republic of Turkey following the Armenian genocide of 1915 to 1923, in which more than 1 million ethnic Armenians are believed to have been killed by Turkish forces. Nationalistic feelings still run high in the communities of the Armenian diaspora scattered around the world, and in the tiny rump of historic Armenia that forms the Armenian Republic today. These tensions have not left Göbekli Tepe untouched, and many Armenians are outraged that Turkey claims this uniquely important site as its own heritage, as though the ancient Armenian connection did not even exist. A few minutes search on the internet using the keyword Portasar, the former Armenian name of Göbekli Tepe, will confirm this. I'll give a single example here, a YouTube video entitled Turkey Presents Armenian Portasar as Turkish Göbekli Tepe. Amongst the comments, fairly typical of the remarks made by many viewers, we read, "This is the way I look at Portasar, Göbekli Tepe. These people deliberately buried a sacred temple. They did this in the anticipation of having it discovered many years in the future. They believed in reincarnation. Those people who built Portasar, Göbekli Tepe, are here among the Armenians. Their spirits have transcended into the Armenian people of today. when you pass on something in your family, you want to make sure that it goes to only that family member and no one else. Porters are, and those lands will be returned back to the Armenians in accordance with the laws of nature. In the same vein, though now entirely within the borders of Turkey, Mount Ararat remains a potent symbol of Armenian nationalism. A landscape of Mount Ararat, with the floodwaters receding and Noah's Ark at the summit, dominates the coat of arms of the Republic of Armenia, while the mountain itself, so near and yet so far, looms over the Armenian capital city Yerevan, a haunting and ever-present reminder that the past is never dead, it's not even past. Thus there are many ways in which the story of Noah and his ark, and of a world made anew after a terrible global cataclysm, is still a living force in the region of Göbekli Tepe, that mysterious sanctuary in the Taurus Mountains, where the great stone circles began to be put in place in 9600 BC, a date that marks the exact end of the long, fatal winter of the Younger Dryas. As Klaus Schmidt asked me rhetorically when I interviewed him at the site, see Chapter 1, how likely is it to be an accident that the monumental phase at Göbekli Tepe starts in 9600 BC, when the climate of the whole world has taken a sudden turn for the better, and there's an explosion in nature and in possibilities? There's something else about that date, too. Just as the beginning of the Younger Dryas in 10,800 BC was accompanied by huge global floods and an episode of rapidly rising sea levels as icy meltwater from the North American ice cap poured suddenly into the Atlantic Ocean, so too, a second global flood occurred around 9,600 BC, as the remnant ice caps in North America and Northern Europe collapsed simultaneously amidst worldwide global warming. The late Cesare Emiliani, professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Miami, carried out isotopic analysis of deep-sea sediments that produced striking evidence of cataclysmic global flooding between 12,000 and 11,000 years ago. So although the floods at the end of the Ice Age could never have carried Noah and his ark thousands of feet above present sea level to the slopes of Mount Ararat, they were indeed global in their extent and would have had devastating consequences for humans living at that time. Mountainous regions such as the Ararat Range would have been natural places of refuge, natural places to bring the seeds of all life, and to start again. Therefore, while the Noah story cannot be literally true in every detail, we must consider the possibility that it is true in its essence, in other words, that it does record the construction of an ark, in which seeds of useful plants and breeding pairs of animals were perhaps preserved by people who already knew agriculture and who possessed architectural skills, who survived the flood, who migrated to the lands between Mount Ararat and Göbekli Tepe, and who subsequently disseminated agricultural and architectural knowledge to the indigenous hunter-gatherers of that region. The sudden and indeed completely unprecedented appearance of giant stone circles at Göbekli Tepe, which surely could only have been conceived and implemented by people with extensive prior experience of megalithic architecture, and the simultaneous invention of agriculture in the exact same locale, are, in my view, highly suggestive of this possibility. Then, too, there is the haunting sense that Göbekli Tepe itself constitutes a kind of ark, frozen and memorialized in stone, for its iconography is not only all about animals but also in a number of intriguing reliefs that show women with exposed genitalia and males with erect penises about human fertility. Imagery of the latter sort, including a figure that Carl Lukert, professor of the history of religions at Missouri State University, interprets as a classic Earth Mother, calls to mind God's command to Moses and his family to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Meanwhile, where else but in Noah's Ark can we find a menagerie as eclectic as the one portrayed on the megaliths of Göbekli Tepe? A menagerie, as we saw in Chapter 1, that includes spiders, scorpions, and snakes, every creeping thing of the earth, birds and cattle, fowls after their kind and cattle after their kind, and foxes, felines, goats, sheep, gazelles, boars, bears, etc., etc. In short, as Genesis 6 verse 20 has it, every kind